Hamas rejects Trump's threats.
They are running out of road. Indeed, they have run out of road. The president has made clear that they need to release the hostages right now.
European leaders meet in Brussels.
Europe faces a clear and present danger, and therefore Europe has to be able to protect itself, to defend itself, as we have to put Ukraine in a position to protect itself.
And are Ukrainian refugees in the U.S. at risk of being sent home?
The Ukrainians who are here without parole and without temporary protective status would be at risk of deportation.
Today is Friday, March 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. On Thursday, Hamas, the U.S.-designated terror group, dismissed President Donald Trump's latest threat, saying it will only free the remaining Israeli hostages in exchange for a lasting ceasefire in Gaza. Hamas accused Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of trying to back out of negotiations to secure the second phase of the ceasefire agreement, which was set to begin early this month. For more on the U.S.-Hamas talks and the Israel-Hamas ceasefire negotiations, we go to Jerusalem.
There are conflicting signals on the future of those ceasefire talks. A Hamas spokesperson in Gaza says President Trump's repeated threats are endangering the ceasefire. At the same time, Egyptian sources say direct talks between the U.S. and Hamas in Qatar have ended positively. Linda Grantstein has our story.
The talks in Qatar marked the first time the United States is known to directly negotiate with U.S.-designated terrorist group Hamas. Participants in the talks included U.S. President Donald Trump's Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff, Hamas leaders, and mediators from Egypt and Qatar. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt confirmed the talks had been held.
Israel was consulted on this matter. And look, dialogue and talking to people around the world to do what's in the best interest of the American people is something that the president has proven is what he believes is a good faith effort to do what's right for the American people.
Egyptian sources said the discussions ended positively and there was hope for an agreement on the second phase of the ceasefire. The first six-week phase of the ceasefire ended last Sunday, but it could be extended as long as negotiations continue on the second phase. A Hamas spokesman said his group is committed to the ceasefire and that mediators are trying to pressure Israel to move forward. This statement came after a Hamas spokesperson in Gaza reacted angrily to threats by President Trump against the group after meeting a delegation of freed hostages. Hazem Qassem said Israeli hostages will only be released through negotiations. He said that if President Trump wants to release the hostages, the U.S. must pressure Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to begin negotiations on the second stage of a ceasefire deal, which calls for a full Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. Israeli government spokesman David Mentzer welcomed President Trump's threats against Hamas, which Israel hopes could help free the remaining 59 hostages, 25 of whom are believed to be alive.
They are running out of road. Indeed, they have run out of road. The president has made clear that they need to release the hostages right now.
Israel this week cut off all international aid entering Gaza in an effort to pressure Hamas to extend the current stage of the ceasefire. The UN World Food Program says only a two-week supply of food remains in Gaza, and the cutoff of fuel is already affecting people there. Nizar Ayash, the mayor of Deir al-Balah in central Gaza, says they are already finding it hard to treat sewage and pump water from wells. He said his city is in a very difficult situation. Ayash says he and other officials are sounding the alarm as they fear cutting off the fuel that the municipalities need to treat sewage, pump water from wells, and lift and remove waste. Israel threatens to resume its attacks on Gaza if the hostages are not released soon. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Turning now to Syria and the delicate process of building a new nation and a new national identity. It's not an easy task after years of separatist struggle and accusations of terrorism. Many Syrians would like to see the U.S.-backed Kurdish forces in the east lay down their weapons or join what they hope would become a national army. But Kurdish leaders say they're still fighting on two fronts and want to negotiate a partnership with Syria's new leadership. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Istanbul with Jan Boishat in northeastern Syria.
In Syria's northeast, the Kurdish-led military, called the Syrian Democratic Forces, are on patrol, searching for Islamic State militants hiding out and planning attacks. The front lines of the SDF's war against Turkish-backed forces have expanded since the Syrian government collapsed late last year. That's when the rebel Syrian National Army took the strategic city of Manbij with Turkey's support. Now, both sides are fighting for a critical dam nearby. The SDF says these battles are inhibiting their ability to fight against the Islamic State. In war zones, SDF fighters use only nicknames for security reasons. This is Haval Guevara, a patrol commander.
The issue is Turkish drones and surveillance. As you know, they attack us in many places, and this gives IS militants the ability to move more freely and easily.
Turkey views the Kurdish fighting forces in Syria as part of a Turkey-based terrorist group, the PKK. Both Turkey and the Syrian forces they support are allied with the caretaker government in Damascus, which is trying to create a national government and army. Speaking by video from Syria to reporters in Washington in February, SDF General Mazlum Abdi says his forces want to join this government and army, but they have not been included in national dialogue.
We do not intend to be the opposition against the new authority in Syria. On the contrary, we look forward to being a partner and to participate in building the new state of Syria.
He says the SDF cannot stay as it is, but he does not say if they would be willing to cede control of their areas or give up weapons. The United States, which has backed the SDF's fight against IS, has signaled the possibility of withdrawing forces from Syria in recent months. But Abdi says U.S. forces are still a critical part of containing IS and negotiating with Turkey. As Islamic State cells hide out in the region, IS prisoners from all around the world are held in jails and camps in northeastern Syria, where many people still hold their radical ideology. At a base on the outskirts of Al-Hasaka, commanders from the YPJ, the women's branch of the SDF's fighting forces, say they're trying to stave off an all-out war. Here is Haval Snarin, a YPJ commander.
Some IS militants are escaping through smuggling themselves into the countryside. They want to create another civil war in the region.
After the collapse of the Syrian government in December, the U.S. military struck 75 IS targets in Syria to prevent the group from taking advantage of a power vacuum and to scare off potential IS allies. But analysts say in the past year, IS attacks have roughly tripled in Syria. Heather Murdoch in Istanbul with Jan Boysha in northeastern Syria, VOA News.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world.
Sudan has filed a case at the International Court of Justice, accusing the United Arab Emirates of breaching the Genocide Convention by arming and funding the rebel paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces, in Sudan's civil war. The ICJ said in a statement that Sudan's case, filed on Wednesday, concerns acts allegedly perpetrated by the Rapid Support Forces and allied militias, including genocide, murder, theft of property, rape, forcible displacement, trespassing, vandalism of public properties, and violation of human rights. The UAE called the filing a publicity stunt and said it would seek to have the case dismissed.
Switzerland says it has decided to cancel a planned meeting of diplomats to discuss the protection of civilians in Palestinian territories, citing what it says are profound differences among countries. The conference, the fourth in a series and the first since 2014, had been set to take place Friday in Geneva. Switzerland, in its role as home to the Geneva Conventions, was to convene the meeting, which aims to protect civilians during armed conflict.
NASA is switching off two instruments on its twin Voyager spacecraft to save power. The space agency said Wednesday an instrument on Voyager 2 that measures charged particles and cosmic rays will shut off later this month. Last week, NASA powered down an instrument on Voyager 1 designed to study cosmic rays. Each spacecraft still has three instruments apiece to study the sun's protective bubble and the swath of space beyond. Both spacecraft are over 13 billion miles from Earth. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strobe. In American domestic politics, U.S. President Trump's administration is planning to revoke temporary legal status for some 240,000 Ukrainians who fled the conflict with Russia, potentially putting them on a fast track to deportation. White House Press Secretary Karine Leavitt said no decision has been made at this time, but a senior Trump official and three sources familiar with the matter said the plans were moving forward.
The move, expected as soon as April, would be a stunning reversal of the welcome Ukrainians received under President Joe Biden's administration. For a deeper dive, I'm joined by Julia Gillott. She's the Associate Director of the U.S. Immigration Policy Program at the Migration Policy Institute.
Yeah, the Ukrainians in the United States have mostly come through a pathway called Uniting for Ukraine, which was a program where people inside the United States could sign up to sponsor somebody or a family from Ukraine. And then that family would arrive with something called humanitarian parole. Humanitarian parole gives people the right to live and work temporarily in the United States. Ukrainians were getting two-year grants of parole. And so they were allowed to live here and work here and were protected from deportation. And were even given access to some of the services that refugees get in the United States.
And this is something that is granted by or can even be taken away from refugees at the sole discretion of the president.
Yeah, that's right. Congress gave the executive branch the ability to parole people into the United States if they don't have a visa or another way to enter legally. There has been some controversy over the use of parole for large groups of people, such as the Ukrainians, and then there was a similar program for parole for people from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. But parole is something that does exist in our immigration law.
Now, there's also something called temporary protective status. What's the difference between that and humanitarian parole? And what's being spoken about in this case?
Yeah. In this case, what we've heard so far is that the Trump administration is considering ending humanitarian parole protections for Ukrainians. About 50,000 Ukrainians, additionally, have temporary protected status. There may be some overlap in those two groups. Temporary protected status, like parole, gives people the temporary right to live and work in the United States. It's usually granted for about 18 months at a time. And about 50,000 Ukrainians have temporary protected status. The Biden administration, before ending their term, extended temporary protected status for about 50,000 Ukrainians through October of 2026. So unless the Trump administration makes an additional move, the Ukrainians who have temporary protected status would continue to have their protections, but the larger number of Ukrainians who are on humanitarian parole could lose their protections.
And what happens when parole goes away? Would these people be asked to leave? Would they be rounded up and deported? How does that end of the system work?
Yeah, they would lose their legal right to live and work in the United States. They may or may not be deported. There are millions of unauthorized immigrants in the United States, and the government doesn't have the capacity to find and arrest and deport all of them. But Ukrainians who were here without parole and without temporary protected status would be at risk of deportation.
Is humanitarian parole a pathway to citizenship, or does it end when the conflict in their home country ends?
Humanitarian parole doesn't give any path to permanent resident status. If the government ended parole or opted not to extend parole, people would face a choice of either living in the United States without legal status or going back home or trying to find another country to live in.
Julia Gillott is the Associate Director of the U.S. Immigration Policy Program at the Migration Policy Institute. Ms. Gillott, thanks so much for your time today. Thanks for clearing this up for me.
Thanks for having me.
Back in Europe, European Union leaders vowed to ramp up support for Ukraine and their own defense arsenal at a summit in Brussels on Thursday, as they take steps to rearm in ways they haven't since the end of the Cold War. From Paris, Lisa Bryant has more on the summit as the region responds to a potentially sharp shift in transatlantic ties.
This was the first summit for all 27 EU members since last week's confrontational White House meeting between U.S. President Donald Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, and after Washington's decision to suspend aid and intelligence sharing with Ukraine.
Europe faces a clear and present danger, and therefore Europe has to be able to protect itself, to defend itself, as we have to put Ukraine in a position to protect itself and to push for a lasting and just peace.
That's the message from European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen about her $865 billion Rearm Europe plan. It aims to drastically boost Europe's defense arsenal against what many here see as a growing Russian threat and possibly the U.S.'s disengagement from the region. She spoke alongside Zelensky, who was invited for part of the summit.
We are very thankful that we are not alone, and these are not just words, we feel it.
J'ai décidé d'ouvrir le débat stratégique.
Beyond boosting Europe's conventional arsenal, French President Emmanuel Macron has floated extending his country's nuclear arsenal to other European allies, which he also explained to French voters back home. In a televised address to the nation Wednesday, he called Russia a threat to Europe for years to come, remarks denounced by Moscow. In Brussels, many EU leaders echoed the urgency of rearming, like Latvian Prime Minister Evika Salina, whose own country borders Russia and has already sharply boosted its defense spending.
We see a good proposals for von der Leyen, but we see it's just one step. We need more steps going forward, and we see really it's a good opportunity for Ukraine to get peace, but through strength.
The EU sees a strong peace deal for Kyiv as serving its own interests as well to ensure Europe doesn't go beyond Ukraine to attack its own member states. But some European leaders have misgivings, including Hungary's Viktor Orban, who has friendly relations with Moscow. Just as important as pouring more money into defense, analysts say, is investing strategically and pooling resources. Here's Ian Lesser, Brussels Bureau Office head for the German Marshall Fund of the United States.
The resources that would be needed to rebuild Europe's defense industrial capacity or to build what is in essence a European army, even within NATO, but for Europe to pay much more and do much more, is going to require some kind of collective action and collective finance, probably.
A key question moving forward, analysts say, is to what extent Europe will be procuring equipment from the United States, as it has in the past, one key way to potentially keep close ties, or investing in its own industrial capacity. Lisa Bryant, VOA News, Paris.
Meanwhile, a similar meeting was being held in Washington. Jeff Selden reports from the Pentagon.
On a windy day at the Pentagon, U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth welcomed his British counterpart to talk about the war in Ukraine and what's next for Europe.
European leadership of NATO, led by the U.K., led by others, is, we believe, the future of defense on the continent.
British Defense Secretary John Healey.
You challenged us to step up on Ukraine, on defense spending, on European security, and I say to you that we are, and we will further.
On potential peace talks between Ukraine and Russia, Healey said Britain believes Kyiv is ready to make the most of a, quote, unique opportunity. But as for whether the U.S. has seen enough to resume intelligence sharing with Ukraine, the U.S. Defense Secretary said that's up to President Donald Trump.
We're very encouraged by the signs we're seeing. Ultimately, he will make the determination, but it is a pause for now.
Hegseth added, Trump is laser-focused on ending the bloodshed. Jeff Selden, VOA News, The Pentagon.
Exiled Cambodian politician and Nobel Prize nominee Mu Socha spoke to Reuters about her worries that women's rights have regressed. Diane To has the story.
You know, we have come so far, and then all of a sudden...
As the world marks International Women's Day in March, exiled Cambodian politician and Nobel Prize nominee Mu Socha says women's rights have regressed. The human rights activist points to global conflicts as well as recent elections in the US and Germany as major concerns.
We as women, because of this political decision and the war and the violence that's going on around the world, what we have gained in terms of political rights freedom, the gains have really been impacted. We are, in fact, going back a lot farther.
Mu is currently president of the pro-democracy organization Khmer Movement for Democracy. She served as Cambodia's Minister of Women's Affairs from 1998 to 2004, before she was exiled in 2017 as an opposition leader. Now based in the United States, Mu spoke to Reuters while she was in Australia for a Congress of the Cambodian Diaspora, where issues of human rights and democracy about their homeland are discussed. Cambodia ranked second last in the World Justice Project's overall index score last year, ahead of only Venezuela. Mu says there are many things women can do to push for change.
We have to be more involved in political choice. And then I think we have to not only mobilize when it is time for election, I think that we have, as women, have to again use our voices, our solidarity, our strength to hold the elected governments accountable.
And she adds, women have to sit at decision-making levels. In 2025, International Women's Day is celebrated under the theme For All Women and Girls, Rights, Equality, Empowerment. It's a theme Mu believes is worth fighting for, despite the challenges facing women.
We cannot stop the fight. We have to fight even harder today.
That's Reuters' Diane To reporting.
With more on International Women's Day, as well as a look at the hard work of journalists operating under a repressive regime, we turn to Afghanistan for this story from VOA's Press Freedom Desk. The Taliban's return to power in Afghanistan brought an abrupt end to Ayman Khiami's education and has stalled the young Afghan woman's dreams of becoming a journalist. But from exile, she is working to achieve her ambition of a career in media. From Peshawar, Pakistan, Muska Safi brings us this story, narrated by Bazan Hamdard.
During her final exam in 11th grade, a teacher told Ayman Khiami and her female classmates to leave. The newly returned Taliban had issued a ban on girls receiving a secondary education. Khiami, in a state of shock, walked out of her school and never returned. That was in 2021. 1 year later, her family fled to Pakistan, hoping for safety and a chance for Khiami and her sister to continue their education. Now 20, she completed 12th grade at a school for refugees, but she faces fresh obstacles, including pursuing a higher education in journalism studies.
I see my future as uncertain here, because getting into university for an Afghan is very difficult. It's been 2 years since I graduated, but I still haven't been able to get admission.
For now, Khiami works as a tailor's apprentice, where she earns about $46 a month to support her family. But she is determined to pursue her passion of becoming a journalist. It's a career that has long appealed to her. Khiami says she was inspired by news anchors in Afghanistan and had hoped to one day be in their place witnessing what is happening.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Khiami attended a video journalism course for refugees and worked for 2 months at a local station in Peshawar, reporting and interviewing locals about their views.
Some news channels interviewed me, but unfortunately, they wanted my education documents, and I did not go to university.
For Khiami, journalism offers a way to amplify the voices of Afghan women at a time when their rights in Afghanistan have been stripped away under the Taliban. The Taliban has barred women from education, work, public spaces, and even raising their voices in public. Living in Pakistan, Khiami can see the difference.
Pakistani girls have easy access to jobs and education. Afghan girls, on the other hand, have repeatedly requested to continue their education, but the Taliban have increasingly imposed more restrictions on them.
If restrictions on women ease in Afghanistan, Khiami would like to return. Until then, she plans to look for opportunities to pursue her dream of becoming a journalist. For Muska Safi in Peshawar, Pakistan, Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
That'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform. and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.